Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette.
From Forget About It. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Joshua David Stein, Variety Hour. Joshua David Stein, Variety Hour.
Half hour!
Hello, this is Joshua David Stein of the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. Today is December 7th, and it is the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And I was thinking of all the ways that I wanted to tackle it on the show. I definitely wanted to discuss World War II, which is important for me and personally. Both my grandparents fought in the war, and important to me as a Jew and as an American. And important to me also as someone who writes about food. I wanted to tackle it in a way that felt authentic to me and felt authentic to the show. When I was growing up, my stepfather was Japanese. He was Japanese-American, born here. And his father, Ben Ohama, and his mother were here also during World War II. So December 7th for them meant something completely different than what it meant for me or what we were taught mostly in history books. For them, it marked the time when they were living out, I think, in Fresno, when they had to enter into a... It started the process which resulted in them being interned in one of the, I think, 10 or so camps. It's called Executive Order 9066, signed by Roosevelt, which basically interned Japanese Americans for the duration of the war. And I was thinking, how does that fit into the show? And I was looking for a way to make it relevant. And I was thinking about how that affected that generation and generations to come of Japanese Americans and how food played a part in them. So our first guest is Tomio Moriguchi. Now, Tomio Moriguchi runs Tomio, are you there?
Uwajimaya.
Thank you, Uwajimaya. Yes, Uwajimaya, which for anyone on the West Coast or in Seattle is one of the biggest and most established Japanese food markets in out there and, I think, in the country. It was founded in 1928. Tell me if I get this right, Tomio, by your father, Fujimatsu.
Right.
And so since 1928, I think uninterrupted, has been providing Japanese food products to a huge Japanese American and Japanese population out there. Before we get into it, Tomio, can you tell me a little bit about Uwajimaya?
Yes, Uwajimaya was started by my father, and the name Uwajimaya comes from a village near the town he was born. And Uwajima was a very well-known fish industry city or town. And so he went there to work and learned his fish business, came to Seattle to make his fortune, or Tacoma. And fortunately, he never did. But anyway, so he started Uwajimaya 1928.
What kind of things did he sell beginning then?
Well, in those days, his customer base was primarily Japanese, working on the railroad and fish camps and oyster farms and things like that. So his customers were Japanese. So he would provide the basic foods like rice, soy sauce, tofu. In addition, he had the edge of making fish cake in the evening and adding that to his list of merchandise he peddled around Tacoma.
And now I think you have 8 locations. Is that right?
No, we have only 4.
Oh, sorry, but 4. I'm jumping ahead.
3 in the Seattle, Washington, and 1 in Oregon. But they're all pretty good size. The largest is 50,000 square feet. The others are 20 to 30,000 square feet. So,
and how has business expanded? What do you sell now? I did see, our listeners might want to check it out, that In Your Meat Case is the most amazing ground beef I've ever seen. There are these sculptures in the shape of cartoon characters, and there's a Tumblr called epicgrinds.tumblr.com, which has these amazing sculptures, meat sculptures. But what else do you – it can't all be meat sculptures. What other sort of products do you guys sell?
Well, getting back to the meat, we probably sell we do sell imported beef from Japan, the highest – well, very high quality. So they're going for close to $80, $90 a pound. And they're very well marbled, and they're either called Kobe beef or Wagyu, but that's just to show you our customer base is pretty varied, but some of our customers want the best, at whatever price, of food products that's related to Japan.
And are they mostly Japanese-American customers, Japanese customers, Anglo customers?
Well, it started out primarily Japanese, but now, I don't know the exact percentage, but, we have Jewish customers that love our fresh fish for sashimi and sushi. And then, we have lots of other Asians like Koreans and Taiwanese and Chinese good relation with Japan.
Yeah. Going back to sort of December 7th and the 9066 wasn't executed, I think, until February 42. But tell me where you were, how old you were at the time, and what was going on with your family, and what happened?
Well, my father was in Tacoma running a business, just coming through the Depression and kind of starting to make a little money. And then that's when the incarceration was, ordered by Roosevelt. There are theories about this whole episode or the removal of Japanese from the West Coast was long planned before the war, and the bombing of the Pearl Harbor just triggered and made it somewhat appear legitimate, but there was a lot of anti-Asian, anti-Japanese feeling from the turn of the century. And so it was just a bad, maybe a perfect storm, depending on what side of the fence you're on. But
right.
It was proven to be unconstitutional, depriving of our constitutional rights. And there were 70% of us were American citizens that were incarcerated.
So did you, I know that Ben Ohama, my my grandfather, he had, and like many Japanese Americans, had only a few days or hours to sell all his property before he was incarcerated. Is that what happened with your father?
Yeah, and let's straighten out term property. They had laws that did not allow Asians to own real estate properties. So when you say property, you're talking about houses or maybe or cars or equipment. And so, yes, they were given probably at the most 10, 12 days, at the shortest couple of days to pack whatever you could carry. And
so what happened to Owajimaya then?
Place. Pardon me?
What happened to Awajimaya when your family was incarcerated?
Well, my father, my parents had four children, and three came along during the camp. But anyway, four children, I don't know what my father did. I think, fortunately, there was a church and some friends that were willing to store some of the stuff that personal belongings. But like I say, my father could not own land, so they did not own land. And I don't know if he could, he could have afforded it. But the point is, it was not real estate land. It was property that was, whatever.
And you guys...
household, yeah.
You,
plus inventory for our business. I think he had to sell his pickup truck, things like that.
And you guys were incarcerated in Tule Lake, which, from reading about, was the seat of a lot of sort of unrest. Of all the internment camps, it was the most, there was martial law, I know, for a while. The army took over. There was a lot of unrest. What was it like? You were a young boy.
We were put there just because of the geographic.
Right.
It evolved to become the so-called troublemaker type of camp. And my father had the option to move out. However, he was very pro-Japan, and he wanted to go take his family back, so he stayed there. But some of our neighbors were moved to, I guess, more friendly camps or something like that. But, yes, that was a pretty, I don't know what term to use, but not the most respected camp, and had higher security and things like that.
And what was it like? What was it like eating? This show is largely devoted to kind of food. Your life has been devoted, not all of it. I know you've had a very varied career, but a lot of it to food and food culture. What was it like eating in these camps? What was mealtime like?
We had most of us lived in small families, so our mothers cooked. But when we were put in camp, I guess the closest thing I could think of is the camps, the internees were rationed basically American Army-type food. So, it kind of depended. If you didn't have too creative of a cook for your mess hall, then you could just imagine GI food, I guess. Fortunately, we had a lot of creative chefs.
Were they mostly
professional,
they were
non-professional that were able to incorporate bed borrow or steal soy sauce as an example? So some of the stuff, I guess, from what I understand, was not so bad. But the other thing that we ate in the mess hall, so the social structure of the family kind of started to fall apart. Those are issues that people don't seem to talk about, but.
Because you didn't eat with your parents.
Pretty bland. I only served 6 months in the Army, but if you could kind of picture what you ate in the Army, that's the kind of food we probably had.
Right, right. And you said that it kind of disrupted the social structure of your family because the children didn't eat with their parents, or because that small family unit was sort of completely demolished?
Probably both of a little bit of both. And then also, some of us boys, I was only 6 or 7, but when you get back, we heard that, certain camp mess hall had better food or treated you better. Then 2 or 3 of us just snuck away and just went to the other camp, other mess hall. So, there was no time for our parents to discipline us or anything like that.
Right.
So the social fiber of a family... just did not sustain itself.
Right. You said that your father, who was born in Japan, wanted to go back to Japan after the war, but he didn't.
Correct.
And
well, I don't know about after the war. This was prior to the war, but he wanted to just make enough money, $10,000, which was 2 to 1. So 10,000 was 20,000 yen in 1920s or something. So if he had 5 or 10,000 dollars, he would have
moved back,
been considered a fairly wealthy person to go back. And he was the oldest of his family, and they had a little bit of property, not a lot, but something at least he could hang his hat on. So that was his dream.
But you said after the war, his family said, don't come back to Japan. We don't have anything for you.
Right. After the war, and here again, I still don't know how they communicated. I was told that the Red Cross helped them a little bit. But anyway, the communication from his two sisters were, we have no food for you if you come back, you know, things like that. And fortunately, actually, probably the reason is my mother has three infant children under her arm, so I think my father hopefully was smart enough to say, hey, I'll go back another day. So we did not go back right after the camp.
How do you think that sort of generational disruption in the fabric of the Japanese-American experience altered, sort of had some changes that are still being felt in Japanese food culture today? Or do you think it has been completely eradicated, the whatever trauma or changes were brought about by the incarceration?
Well, you know, every family is a little different, but the thread to me is that people didn't talk about it, so it's only going to be the next generation that could really objectively analyze your question. It's very difficult, and you know, you said you have in-laws or outlaws that were Japanese. You know, culturally, they probably didn't talk a hell of a lot about it, but they probably had some thoughts about it, and those thoughts were slowly emerging in some, I don't know, educated ways.
Right.
But it's a very complex issue, but my gut feeling is it has hurt the Japanese people like myself or older, probably older generation in ways that they don't understand or they don't want to admit or they don't want to discuss.
You had mentioned something about your father was concerned that you would only eat hot dogs when you got out. But actually what ended up happening was, since your mother and father both had to work, you were raised by, or your grandparents had a big part in raising you, and they cooked very traditional Japanese food. So in a way, did this sort of like post-war mobilization of the workforce and rebuilding all these things, which left children in the care of their grandparents, their very traditional grandparents, did that sort of safeguard some traditional Japanese food?
Oh, for sure. And this is some of the unforeseen consequence. And it's not only the Japanese family, you know, the parents and the mother of most American families had to work right after the war. And so this phenomenon, but, you know, in my father's generation and probably your grandparents' generation, the women stayed at home and cooked all the meals and things like that. But the whole culture of American culture, probably, you know, the women went out to work, and so the fabric of the family changed, mm-hmm. and the grandparents kind of stepped in and, you know, had to take care of the grandchildren, and then actually at dinner and lunch, you know, we were given Japanese food.
Right.
And, you know, it's probably tradition. But the point is, those are unexpected. But having said that, that helped our business because the grandmothers would come to feed their grandchildren, and they would buy rice and, you know, soy sauce because that's what they were raised in. So actually, that's the kind of food they prepared, which helped our business.
Right. Tomio Moriguchi, thank you for taking a couple of moments to speak with me about this. I think it's an interesting and important subject, which isn't often talked about. And, have a wonderful day. Thanks again.
Thank you. Good luck.
Welcome back to the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour. This is our second half, where we traditionally have a musical guest, and we have a musical guest tonight. The man's name is Farrell Foster. You hear him drumming on his guitar in the background. Farrell, before we start, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing this suit. I'm playing a show later tonight at Brooklyn Rotting Gun Club, which is closing down. I decided to wear this suit that I used for a music video shoot earlier this week my friend made for me.
Well, for our listeners, it's a white suit with red sequins, red tuxedo stripes along the side of the pants, brilliant silver sequins on the sleeves, and a front sort of placket of red sequins. And Farrell Foster looks amazing.
I'm glad you think so. I like this suit as well.
So we just heard a story of alienation. I think you have a song about alienation.
Oh, I have so many songs about
alienation. All your songs are about alienation.
Okay. I guess I'll play this one.
Are you good?
Yeah. This is on my record that came out in May that I am, you know, selling. It's available on
Bandcamp. Where do you buy it, Farrell?
On Bandcamp. Okay. Farrellfoster.bandcamp.com. It's just FerrellFoster. You can Google it. And it's available for download there and wherever I'm playing shows. So, this song is the first song on the record. I play with the band on the record. I'll play this acoustic now. It's mostly how I play out. And this is New World Blues. Ooh, 1 second. Sorry. I never worked. Short on time.
We're good.
The
take your time.
Pick is a little better. It's a short song. There we go. There we go. This one's rounded. Better for this one.
That song feels so ferociously lonely to me.
Well, I think I wrote it when I was, it had to do a lot with me with when I was in Red Hook, working at Jalopy at the time, right after the hurricane, and during Sandy, because like it just that was a kind of, there was a really panicked vibe everywhere, where everybody seemed to be taken aback, and I guess that kind of was like, it's more of a, it's kind of a musically driven song. It's kind of have this like very I don't know, I guess it just like kind of what came to me.
Yeah. Yeah, during, so you wrote it in the aftermath of Sandy.
Yeah, yeah, because it was just, there seemed to be, everything was just turned upside down.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, the last, one of the last guests played a show, played a song that he wrote about the oil spill in the Gulf. I feel like we get a lot of, like, environmental blues trauma songs going on.
Environmental blues trauma, it's a new genre.
Yeah, John Spencer and the environmental blues trauma. Let's hear another one. What, tell us what you're going to play next. Anything food related?
Huh? I don't really have any food related songs. It's funny because I'm such a foodie kind of person. Not foodie, I hate that term.
But you're a food person.
Yeah, I love to cook and all that stuff. But nothing in the songwriting, I guess. Well, what? I'll continue with the alienation vibe.
Oh, I love it.
I'll go with that. This is a newer one. Oh, maybe blow the horn.
No, I like alienation.
Oh, it's, well, yeah.
It brings us closer together.
This one is, I don't even have a name for it yet. It's a newer one.
Joshua David Stein Variety Hour, half hour exclusive.
Tales that are told.
executioner's mask. The truth that is always veiled thin. The cold sweat that collects on his skin.
Beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
It's a new one. Can you just give us a little bit of outro instrumental music? Maybe something a little
outro
atmospheric. That'll be the end of the show. Love it. That was the Joshua David Stein Variety Hour Half Hour. I'm your host, Joshua David Stein. I'd like to thank all our guests tonight, Tomio Moriguchi, Farrell Foster, and our lovely engineer, Jack Inslee. We'll see you next week. Stay safe.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.